thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
It's Digital Campus number 77 for the 21st of November, 2011. FERPA nuts? Welcome back. It's time once again for another edition of the Digital Campus podcast, this time featuring the original regulars. Can we call ourselves that? The hardcore.
The OGs.
The OGs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's the gangsta edition with us three nerdy white guys. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome back to our regular and new listeners. I hear Tom Scheinfeld on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hi, everybody.
Tom can be found at foundhistory.org and at foundhistory on Twitter. And Mills Kelly, who is not available on Twitter but is available at edwired.org, is here as well. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Tom. Glad your power's back on.
Yes, I've been restored. It actually was a few days. It was like another 5 days from when I think I talked to you guys last on Digital Campus. So it was for a total of 11 days.
My goodness. So, how did you survive?
After the fact, you sort of feel like, you know what, that wasn't that bad, which is why nothing changes.
Right.
Everybody just kind of quickly, as soon as the power's back on, you know, it's not like your house flooded or something, you know, where there's like lingering effects. It's just, you just kind of, power comes back on and
you're
right back in it. So,
well, you know, hopefully when we're, you know, 30 years older than we are now, then we'll have righteous indignation for months. And show up at town hall meetings and these sorts of things.
Right.
All right. Well, with the power problems behind us, let's get to the problems of the day. Our top story, Georgia Tech wiping wikis from the web for their classes. What is going on here? The story coming to us both from the Chronicle and from Audrey Waters, an irregular on the program, who's blogged it at hackededucation.com, we'll link to these from our show notes, of course, at digitalcampus.tv, notes that a student invoked FERPA, the dreaded FERPA, which is not an animal from the Star Wars trilogy, but is a law relating to what educational institutions can do with private student information. Mills, can you explain this, how FERPA made it impossible for Georgia Tech to keep wikis up on the web involving student information and class lecture notes?
You know, I wish I could. The short answer is the extreme risk aversion of higher education institutions when it comes to FERPA and all other such things. The specifics of the case is that for more than a decade, almost a decade and a half, Georgia Tech has been using classroom wikis in all sorts of really interesting ways. And what's especially nice about what they've done is that they've kept these wikis archived over time, and so it makes it possible for students in a course this semester to cross-reference work from work that somebody else did in a course last semester. And so you can imagine this whole process of knowledge building over time among student populations, which is, of course, what they should be doing when they graduate. And
right.
So it's a really useful professional lesson as well. But apparently in this case, the student complaint was that in some way the student and the student's work product was identifiable through one of these classroom wikis. And so in the classic case of doing vascular surgery with a medieval meat axe, Georgia Tech took the entire system down. and you know, deleted all, I mean, I'm sure they deleted them to backup servers, but deleted every single one of the wikis going back to 1997, apparently, from their servers. And so all of this knowledge that's built up over time is suddenly unavailable. And you can imagine all the professors who were using this tool in their courses this semester suddenly having, you know, 8 million emails arrive in their inbox from their students saying, I can't access the wiki. What's happened? I need to finish my project before the end of the semester. And the poor students, of course, thinking that, you know, how am I going to finish my work so I can get the grade I need? And it's just all gone.
So the issue wasn't the course content per se. That's okay to be up, and we should probably mention that FERPA is this
the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act.
Thank you.
From 1974. Yes. Which of course was written with an anticipation of what digital technology would do decades later.
Right. I believe the 1974 law says, do not store punch cards in unlocked rooms right. Unless you have the Doberman pincher in the room with the punch cards. Okay. Yeah, So there's this.
It was probably written to address. I mean, of course, I was in high school in 1974, so I was not paying close attention, but I would be willing to bet that it was written to address such things as when I was a freshman in college, it was very you know, you took an exam and then you walked by the professor's office the next day and the TA had posted your name and your grade on the wall, or your social security number and your grade on the wall, so you could figure out what grade you'd gotten. And so, okay, if you got an A, that was fine and you were happy. If you got an F, that might be a little embarrassing. So, but that was history professors grading a whole bunch of papers and throwing them in a box outside their office for everybody to paw through. So, you know, to deal with those kinds of analog privacy problems. This case raises, I think, some really important, this example, because it's not a case in Georgia Tech, it's just an example, raises, I think, some really important issues for the future of things that we're doing with digital technology and teaching. So, for instance, this semester I'm teaching an honors seminar, and I have a group of students, who each of whom is required by their professor to write a blog. And those blog posts are then aggregated into a class blog. Many of us, you know, you do this with your courses as well, Dan, I know. Now, I did not say to the students that they had to identify themselves on their blog. They had to tell me which blog was theirs, because several of the students have not identified themselves. You know, their blog name, one of them is AA.
And
that's fine. You know, as long as I know who it is, I don't care if they identify themselves. You know, I think none of them identified themselves fully. They, you know, Craig or whatever. But they, you know, they've maintained their own level of privacy in that. But they're not only posting work online for others to potentially read, they're writing about their work. And so it's not you know, so there are sort of two levels of this. And and of course, I'm not posting any kinds of grades. I'm not, you know, the only evaluation of mine that you can read is where I write comments on what they've written and say, you know, have you thought about this? Or maybe you could focus your analysis a little more here, or the really interesting point, maybe you should look at this source. Those kinds of feedback loop comments that students get all the time in the classroom. So now am I in FERPA violation?
Here's Mark Guzdial, a professor in the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech. He says, explaining this removal of these wikis, Georgia Tech's interpretation of FERPA is that protected information includes the fact that a student is enrolled at all. Now, wait a second. That's simply wrong. Okay, but if we go there, right, even if someone has a pseudonym on their blog, I think it's rather easy for outside people to figure out who's in your class, Mills, or who's in my class, right? I mean, we have students blogging, you know.
Well, here's what I don't understand. I mean, I think what matters here is who is doing the posting. I mean, I can understand how it would be a violation of my privacy if the university, and the language in the law says, FERPA prohibits, quote, prohibits the release of student names in connection with any particular classes in which they have been enrolled. I can understand how I wouldn't want the university saying, you know, yeah, Tom Scheinfeld took Econ 101 and, you know, and then that becomes public knowledge. And then, you know, I go to apply for a job and, you know, in the job interview, they say, well, how'd you do in Econ 101? And I have to say, well, actually I withdrew because I biffed the midterm or whatever. I mean, I can understand how that would be a privacy concern, but I think there's a difference between the university releasing the information and a student himself or a student's fellow student releasing the information. Mm-hmm. I mean, so like, how can the university be held responsible if another student says, oh yeah, Joe is in my class. Oh, and by the way, I think he got a B on the midterm.
Right.
I just, you know, that's what I, so who is posting this information? I think is a key, you know, is a key question here.
Right. I mean, it really calls into question a lot of just, I guess what we call collaborative and interactive pieces of the modern academy with digital technology. I mean, it's not just on wikis. I mean, I think everyone focused in the story on the wikis, but it's really not the wikiness of it, right? It's the fact that there are open forums for exchange, collaboration, aggregation of academic information. I assume this is happening in the open on Facebook. You know, how was your Econ 101 class, Dan? Those kinds of things.
Or you know, if I assign my students to create a website as a class project, and on the about page now it should read student 1, student 2, student 3.
Mm. Right.
I mean, yeah, so the students, you know, maybe they can on their own take credit for, you know, and say, no, I don't want to be student 1. I want to be, you know, Mills Kelly, and so, yeah, because I want people to know I did this work. But, you know, if you take a really strict interpretation, I would have to say, no, sorry, I can't do that, because later you might change your mind and accuse me of a FERPA violation.
Right.
And so maybe I have like this very complicated release form crafted by 9 different lawyers who then, you know, the student has to sign and I have to keep an archived copy in perpetuity just in case a student at age 42 decides, wow, that website was really embarrassing. I'm that, you know, that's a FERPA violation.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous.
Okay. So larger question here, I think, is this is just going to get worse, right? I mean, there is a note that says that the Department of Ed is currently revising FERPA laws, but only really to, for instance, make an anonymized data for, you know, studies, longitudinal studies, those sorts of things, not really updating it for a digital age. And yet, you know, we have all these professors now who are picking up, let's say, an iPhone or an Android phone that presents the option of backing up or reproducing data from the phone, including emails to students and these sorts of things, to the cloud, to a space off campus, perhaps not public or at least intentionally public. But am I wrong that there's just a whole lot of leakiness in the system that doesn't match up with, you know, FERPA's 1974 ideal?
Oh, it's a sieve.
Yeah, right.
The system is a sieve. That, you know, The Economist actually had a very interesting piece about this a few weeks ago about just on the telecommunications side, why big companies are really struggling with this exact same issue, because they've, you know, they've built these kind of closed internal networks. It's one of the reasons they like BlackBerries more than iPhones, and that, you know, their sort of their data processing systems are relatively enclosed, but their employees are bringing their iPhones and their Android phones and their iPads and other sorts of things with them into the building, and because they're not willing to be entirely cut off from, you know, day-to-day work. Now, you
right,
know,
right.
You know, it's, or day-to-day life. And so, you know, and they're backing things up and they want to use their new devices.
Yeah. I mean, I think it feels like a lot hinges on this word release, you know, what it means to release student data. You know, it in an analog world, you know, when the channels of release were, you know, the phone, the mail, radio, and television. You know, it was sort of clear cut, like what it meant to release. Like if somebody called you on the phone and said, "Can you tell me Susie's grades?" You would say, "No," and that was, you know, and that was actually just right. kind of common sense. Now, well, does backing your email up to the cloud constitute release of student data? I think that, you know, that seems like something that needs to be clarified.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really, if this is really strictly interpreted and not changed, you know, it throws into question a lot of the practices, I think, that we've discussed on the podcast, you know, using new media in the classroom in a lot of ways, using web services for classes that, you know, don't have strict firewalls. You know, I think a lot of that would be closed off. Maybe this is a huge boon for the Blackboards of this world that want to contain everything in a nicely administered from the top, you know, intra-institutional aspect. I just don't see how this is going to work. I have a feeling this is not the end of the story, right? I mean, we're going to have cases. I think it's interesting that it was a student complaint. I can't imagine many students actually know about FERPA, but if they did, Mills would be going to jail. So
yeah, that's right.
I would have been in jail
long ago.
Yes.
You know, and I, you know, Tom's point, I think, is a really good one, and that is that there are all sorts of common sense aspects to this. And so, you know, I tell my students all the time, don't call me and ask about your grade. I won't answer you over the phone because I don't know that it's you. And and as anybody who's taught in higher education for very long has had phone calls from parents wanting to know about their child's grade. And I have a little speech that I'm very proud of that I give to parents about FERPA, about how I feel their pain, but sorry, I'm not going to tell you what your child's grade is. And here's the procedure for getting a release from your child, and you can follow all these bureaucratic twists and turns and then come see me. But the so there are lots of good common sense aspects to FERPA, but to just take this sort of blanket interpretation, I go back to what I said before, it's part of a, I think, a general risk aversion culture in higher education, and that limits our ability to innovate. And so, for instance, one of the things we try to do in the program that I run is we do a lot of advising, and we have multiple advisors, and students try to come see their advisor, but if their advisor is busy, we want them to get advised, so we send them to someone else who happens to be available. That person writes some notes about the conversation, and right now, because the university cannot provide a service like Dropbox, we have to write those notes out by hand and walk them down the hall, where if we could just put them in an advising document and have them in Dropbox, then, or something like Dropbox, you know, something parked in the cloud, then we could all have easy access to them. But that would be a FERPA violation according to the university, because Dropbox is not sufficiently secure.
And so
therefore we don't do it. We share all of our internal documents that have nothing to do with students in this way. But the stuff that we do every single day and is really important, we can't share in that way because our university cannot provide us with a tool that is, okay, last time I checked, free online and is used by millions of people. And so we're limited because they're, you know, the universities just can't keep up, and they're scared to death of a lawsuit.
Yeah,
I do think, Mills, you're absolutely right that when it comes to technology, universities are incredibly risk averse, and that the remedies, you know, for these things that they come up with are entirely outsized to the problem. It seems like in other areas they manage risk. Like there's a risk that a student walking down the hallway of Robinson is going to slip and fall and break her neck, but we don't ban people from walking down the hallways of our buildings because that's a possibility. But when something like this happens, we just get rid of the entire system. You know, it's like we take the whole thing down.
Right.
Or when there's, you know, there's file sharing going on campus, we make everyone sign a pledge that they're not going to file share. You know, we don't make everyone sign a pledge that they're not going to run in the hallways. you know, I mean, it's just, it's like when it comes to technology, the remedies that the remedies that universities have come up with to address the risk are completely out of proportion to the actual risk, and that's not true in other areas.
Yeah, like for instance, I can't walk in and out of my building without walking through huge clouds of tobacco smoke because they've created a smoking area right by the front door.
Yeah, it's just there's like all kinds. I mean, you know, like risk is inherent in all kinds of things that universities do. But when they it comes to technology, the reaction is so much stronger, and it's so much, you know, sort of, it's a blanket reaction.
Well, here's yet another blanket reaction, just hot off the wire from the Associated Press. The University of Missouri, which had been like many other universities across the United States and worldwide, has moved fairly aggressively into recording lectures for podcasts and later consumption, the use of new technologies or new distribution channels like iTunes U. Well, after conservative blogger Andrew Breitbart took a videotaped classroom lecture of, let's see, a student in, professor in labor studies, and heavily edited it to suggest that the professor and a colleague advocated union violence. The university has decided that that students can just blanket statement, students can no longer tape lectures. So they have to ask for the permission of the professor, and said that this is the first time since the advent of portable tape recorders more than 50 years ago that a policy has been instituted where the students must obtain written permission from professors and classmates to record a lecture. Mills, you've been a proponent of recording lectures. You've done it yourself. This is a policy drafted by campus attorneys. What's your feeling on this? Is it okay?
Sorry. I had to mute my microphone for a minute because I was laughing so hard.
I didn't make this story up. I'm going to link to it from...
I would like to invite any blogger, radical left, radical right, anybody, come to my class anytime you want, tape it, post it online, edit it, you know, make me, you know, whatever.
Right. It reminds me of the classic Simpsons episode where he goes on some talk show and then they edit it and there's a clock in the background. You can see the clock, you know, spinning back and forth to various times of the hour as they cut and paste, you know, single words to make him look like an idiot. So, yes, Mills, I would love to, you know, I've got Audacity running right now. Maybe I'll go ahead and edit some of your lectures to make you look foolish.
There you go. I'm all about looking foolish. So
professors are with you. I mean, it says in this AP article that that there's a bunch of Missouri professors are saying that their restrictions are impractical and contradict the public university's goal of promoting shared knowledge.
Exactly. Because, I mean, okay, I work for the Commonwealth of Virginia. I am a public employee. The teaching that I do is work made for hire. It is a public service to the people of the Commonwealth of Virginia and those who are paying to have access to that service if they're coming from out of state. And the whole goal is to share knowledge and promote educational values and goals. And so, therefore, I would put more students in my classes if I could, based on the size of the class or the, you know, how I'm teaching that particular class. And so if somebody wants to set up a video camera, my classes would not work so well because I don't do a lot of lecturing, but they're welcome to do that. And, you know, if they want to edit it, fine.
They can also quote you out of context. I mean, like, yes, they could take your book and, you know, patch together sentences taken from various chapters and, you know, portray you as a Nazi.
I mean, that's right. I would refer people back to the original.
Right. So let's ban faculty publications.
You know what? Perfect solution. Let's just ban all representation of knowledge, and then we won't have these problems. We'll just all come into class and we'll stand there or sit there and stare at each other for 50 minutes, and then the students will all leave and we'll all be protected. You know, it's one of the ironies in all of this, of course, is that at least according to the general counsel for the Rhode Island School of Design in the Chronicle story about the Georgia Tech thing, is that students are not subject to the provisions of FERPA. So if they're the ones posting the material online, then they're outside the confines of the Privacy Act. So if I'm if this is true, and I'm not an attorney, but sorry, I'm laughing because the whole thing strikes me as so absurd. But the if this is true, this means that a student could take his or her phone and videotape the other students in the room, post it on Facebook or YouTube, tagging each of the students with their names. And this would not, these are the morons in my econ class, and their names are, you know, Bob Smith and Susie Jones, and they're all stupid and they all got D's on these, or post their grades over their heads. And this would not be illegal under FERPA.
It is.
So, I mean, the whole system is totally out of whack.
You know, Jay Rosen, the journalism professor at NYU, he was the subject of one of these conservative recording sting operations a couple months ago. And, you know, I think he had the proper solution, which was not a policy change, but he, you know, wrote a long piece saying, you know, exactly what the entirety of the class was about that this mole was visiting as a putative prospective student in at NYU. And, you know, gave the full story and say, you know, look, you can decide for yourself. Obviously, these are quotes that are taken out of context. You know, this is, you know, in a YouTube age, I guess this is to be expected, right?
You go into YouTube now and you can watch all sorts of videos shot by students of,
right,
this is my stupid calc professor, or, you know, or
is there a channel for this? I think my lit professor is hot, you know, and so you
can watch all of this stuff. One solution is total disclosure, and that is you set up a video camera in your room and you videotape each and every one of your lectures and post them online. And that, but of course, to make sure, remember now, make sure that it's only you in the video, that if even the back of a student's head appears, you could be in violation of FERPA. But so you have the, you know, the videographer just following your head around the room as you walk.
Well, that's as with so many of these kinds of issues, the answer, I mean, the reactionary answer is to, you know, shut it down. No audio, no video, no recording, nothing. I mean, but the only solution is more sunlight,
right? more transparency.
That's the only real solution is to, you know, I mean, if this entire lecture had been recorded and was up on iTunes U and on YouTube and everything, Breitbart wouldn't have been able to make his stupid video, right? Because anybody who wanted to take the time to point back to it could have said, no, yeah, you've taken all this out of context, here's the original. That more transparency is the answer, but the reaction from lawyers is to try to control and try to shut it down. I will say
not just from lawyers, because I wrote a piece for Perspectives, the AHA newsletter, I don't know, in the late 90s, in 99 or 2000, I think, called Towards Transparency in Teaching, which we'll post a link to. And I got some, you know, supportive emails like, hey, I read your piece, I completely agree. And I got some other emails from people saying, this is nuts. I am not going to let other people watch me teach in this way because it'll be used against me. And now they weren't worried about Andrew Breitbart. They were worried about tenure and promotion committees or things like that. They wanted to keep their classrooms closed to outside viewing, and which just proves Tom's point. I mean, anybody who feels that way, I think needs a little transparency dose. This is all reminds me of after September 11th and the huge increase in airport security. We're taking off our shoes, we're taking off our belts and all this. Some columnist for the Washington Post wrote a piece proposing a simple and elegant solution, and that is naked airlines. The only way you could get on the plane was to strip entirely. And since everyone would be naked, it would be applied equally. No one could be accused of profiling you because everyone was naked. And of course, this would also probably keep radical Muslims off the plane because of their objection to public nudity. And so it was the total transparency in air travel. So this is what we need. There's total transparency in higher ed to solve the problem.
Are you proposing naked classrooms, Mills?
Never, never.
Ah, gosh. Man. I should probably note, just an editor's note here, now that I've done a little bit more research than I normally do before proposing a story on the podcast, it actually says that this is a policy proposed by the administration and that actually the campus attorneys are reviewing it for validity. In other words, in the face of the fact that it's a public taxpayer-funded University of Missouri.
Even more to the point that I made, it's all about risk aversion.
Yeah.
Even the attorneys are not sure that it's bad.
Yeah. Right.
But the university administration, terrified of even the possibility of a lawsuit, will just shut down an entire teaching and learning operation that's been going on for a decade.
Or even bad
press.
That
strikes me as good leadership.
Yeah. Mm. All right, it's time to move on, but we do encourage the listeners of the Digital Campus podcast to remix this podcast to make all of us look smarter. Thank you for that assistance.
That might be too difficult, but...
Speaking of smarter, Google Scholar is trying to get a little bit smarter about the way it identifies articles and other written materials that it catalogs. It's scholar.google.com. By releasing something it calls Google Scholar Citations. Tom, you took a look at this. What's the point of this new service?
Well, I think the attraction to it for a scholar is it gives you kind of an interface for tracking how your publications are being used and where they're being cited. And so it provides alerts and it gives you some visualizations of how your work is being used by colleagues. So that's kind of the reason why you might sign up for this thing. But effectively, what it's doing is it's an identity. It's providing Google with an identity system. It's basically tying your Google identity, your Google profile, to a set of publications. So when you go in to sign up for this, basically what happens is you click on the link, and it says, hi, Tom Scheinfeld, because I'm logged into Gmail and I'm logged into Google Plus and everything. It says, are these your publications?
Isn't that scary? I'm walking through this right now.
Yeah.
ID'd me and everything. Yeah.
I stopped halfway.
Yeah.
I think it's a FERPA violation. I think it is.
I stopped halfway just because I wanted to take a step back and think about, okay, is this something I actually want associated with my profile?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe it is. Do I really want to link up Google's databases? you're creating a crosswalk for Google, saying okay, you've got all this data on this guy Tom Scheinfeld who writes about this stuff, and then you've got all this data about this guy Tom Scheinfeld who uses your email service and your social network, and you're saying, you're letting Google join those tables and yes, these are the same people, and go do whatever you're going to do with that. And so I'm not sure I want to let Google do that. Clearly they already kind of have. But I just don't want to, I don't know if I'm ready to confirm that. So I probably will sign up for this thing, cause I'm sure the benefits will outweigh, whatever I perceive as the costs. Or maybe there aren't any costs, but I had a kind of moment where I seized up and said, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What do they really know about me, and how are they going to use this?
It gives you a new sort of personal homepage that's at scholar.google.com with a user ID for you. That's actually seems to be a different user ID than, let's say, a Google Plus ID. And then a very scary page that basically shows all of your academic activity in the last 20 years, with bar graphs showing that, you had a bad 2008 where you weren't cited that often and you were a deadbeat in 2009, but then you rebounded in 2010. Oh my gosh. What I find interesting is at the very bottom, it says, dates and citation counts are estimated and determined automatically by a computer program.
Yes, right. Well, I mean, that's the other problem.
So, I guess
it has all of the problems that these citation counts and citation metrics have. And it's just kind of putting those problems incredibly front and center. Right. And also for fields that, you know, like for the humanities, where we don't really traffic in those, in that currency of citation counts.
Well, clearly, trying to get into the competition for these citation metrics that are very popular, products from Thomson Reuters and other companies. Mills, are you going to sign up for this?
I tried it out. I kept my profile private, which is one of the options. And 2008 was good for me.
Huzzah.
2010, not quite so good, apparently. So.
Right. So, that's the other thing is that, like, but, for the humanities, where, the primary or certainly the premier product is the book, it doesn't quite, an annual graph doesn't maybe quite work, if you're publishing a book every 5 years. It kind of first of all doesn't work for the humanities, these kinds of metrics. And I mean, not that they work that great for the sciences either, but there's some more it's a more accurate reflection of at least the way the sciences work and the things that they value. This doesn't even really map onto our values terribly well, or it doesn't, it's kind of a difficult thing for humanists, I think, to begin with, and then to make it public and to, it's just, there's all kinds of questions I think about this that we're.
JSTOR does something like this now. Have you guys seen this?
No.
So when I was in Switzerland last week, somebody showed it to me, and I haven't had a chance to go back and look, but it's like some new feature that it's sort of, I think they've done it kind of the way Google does, they just kind of put things out there and wait to see if anybody's going to use it. But so I'm going to have to go back and look and see. And so if you're a listener to the podcast and you've tried this new JSTOR service where you can, and it graphs out citations or the use of language and it came up in a session where somebody began their session at that camp Switzerland showing a TED talk about the Google's Ngram viewer, and someone else said, "Oh, you can do the same kind of thing now in JSTOR." And so we took a brief look at it, but I haven't had a chance to go back and look carefully. So this kind of data mining is interesting, but if I were in physics, this would actually really matter to me.
Yeah, sure.
But in history, it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah, I can imagine it's very addictive. These kinds of metrics where, more or less the community feels that they're accurate, then it becomes like a little count of your existence, yet another count of your existence. I think we need to wrap up, but I do hope that our audience takes us up on this or create a dance remix of one of Mills's lectures. I would love for that to happen. You'll get a free copy of this edition of Digital Campus, and we hope to see you again in 2 weeks.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.